Nexus PMG welcomes you to the Bigger Than Us podcast, which we as energy geeks lovingly refer to as the BTU. Bigger Than Us is a podcast that focuses on ideas that will shape the future of our planet and ultimately our existence. We will occasionally lean into energy topics because, after all, it's the key to our collective survival, but we'll also explore other ideas and topics that we believe will have an impact that is bigger than us. And now, on to today's show. Hello and welcome to the Bigger Than Us podcast. I'm your host, Raj Daniels, and today I'd like to welcome Michael Sheldrick to the show. Michael Sheldrick is a policy entrepreneur and a driving force behind the efforts of Global Citizen to end extreme poverty. As a co-founder and chief policy, impact, and government affairs officer, he leads the organization's campaigns to mobilize and support from governments, businesses, and foundations. He is the author of the upcoming Amazon best-selling book, From Idea to Impact, a playbook for influencing and implementing change in a divided world. Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm going great, Raj, joining you from Melbourne, Australia, and it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Michael, it's 2 p.m. here in Dallas. What time is it in Melbourne?
It's 7:05 a.m., bright and early. nice late summer day here in Melbourne.
Well, good morning to you. And to kick off, I think one of your favorite quotes, the best way to begin is to begin, Eleanor Roosevelt, is that correct?
Yeah, that's great. I use that in the book. You've done your homework there. Very good. Usually I'm sharing that when someone says, what is your favorite quote? But you already know the answer. And that's right. Look, First of all, I think Eleanor Roosevelt was a remarkable woman. People focus a lot on her husband, that she was the first U.S. ambassador to the UN, founded the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But I just love that quote. You know, I saw it. I went up to Hyde Park, upstate New York, a few years ago to visit where the Roosevelts lived. And I saw that as a fridge magnet. I'd never seen it before. And it just encapsulates so much of what I believe about the work I do. You know, we can stress about strategies and we can lead to analysis paralysis, but sometimes you just have to get out there, make things happen, and the forward momentum from that can take on a life of its own.
Well, I love that quote too. And as the father of three daughters, we're kind of feminists here too. And so Eleanor Roosevelt stands out in our household also. I think one of the quotes to paraphrase her is something along the lines of, you know, be you because no one else can be you. You're the best at being you. So that's one I use with my kids quite often.
I didn't know that one. As you know, Raj, I just had a 3-month, I've got a daughter who's now 3 months old. And so I have to remember that one. That's a great quote.
Well, I appreciate it. So let's begin in the beginning. How do we get to Global Citizen?
Yeah, so I grew up in Perth, Western Australia. Perth, for any of your listeners who aren't aware, is the most isolated city in the world. I never traveled around the world. You know, my life and my purview on the world was very much the southwest corner of Australia. But how I got involved in Global Citizen initially, you know, at high school, I wasn't very academically gifted at the start, certainly wasn't very gifted from a sports perspective, but I had some amazing teachers who really saw potential in me when I didn't see it myself. And so they really encouraged me to challenge myself. They encouraged me to aspire to better than probably where the destination in which I was headed. And the upshoot of all of that is, you know, ended up graduating in the top 1% of the state, got into law school. But, you know, I never really, you know, in Australia, we have this saying, never have tickets on yourself, right? Like, always remember where you come from. And so when people were saying, oh, you're so smart, you've done all of this stuff, you know, I didn't believe that hype, because I always remembered how I felt before I had these amazing teachers and the impact that they had on me. And as I got into university and learned more about the wider world and just became so much more aware of many of the inequities, the injustices in the world, you know, the fact that there's millions of children far more intelligent, far more talented than I am, but because they don't have access to quality education or maybe a great healthcare system, would never be able to realize their potential. So as I got into university, you know, I started volunteering. You know, my first act in university was honestly just to throw events, quiz nights, sausage sizzles, which in Australia is sort of like a barbecue. You put a sausage on a piece of bread and then flog it for a few dollars here and there. Raised money to build schools in countries like Timor-Leste, India, Bangladesh, Papua New Guinea. But as I got more involved and I would actually travel in my summers and winters to volunteer in these countries, I realized, wow, poverty, lack of education, these are huge structural issues. And no amount of quiz nights or charity black tie gala night dinners is going to raise the billions needed to address it. And so Global Citizen was really born in response to that recognition, the idea that systemic challenges require systemic solutions, and we need movements, we need citizens involved, we need everyday advocates. And yeah, that was really within which the genesis of Global Citizen came from.
So just for the benefit of those listening, let me interpret. Flogging is a word that means to sell. I'm from England originally, so I'm very familiar with the word. Quite often, it can also mean to sell, not through, how can I say this correctly? Not through entirely legal means, you know, perhaps bad at the back of a truck, setting up a trolley somewhere, perhaps some secondhand goods, usually flogging stuff like that out of from the marketplace.
Well, I can tell you, I'm not sure actually if my sausages would have lived up to health and safety protocols. So maybe I don't know if it was entirely legal, but it was certainly, you know, one thing I had a knack for was going around the local shopping center and asking for stuff for free. And you'd get all these gifts and, you know, we'd come up with quiz nights and raffle them off, et cetera, give them away as prizes. But, you know, one thing early on I realized is I didn't have many great skills or talents, but asking for things or asking people to do things and just being a pain in people's behind was something I was relatively good at.
Well, that in itself is a superpower.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. We know this, of course. Like, this is almost a cliche, right? Don't be afraid of people saying no. The worst they can do is say no and you move on to someone else. But it's amazing as I train my team and we have new colleagues join us or other people reach out to advice. You know, it's funny. And even sometimes I find myself catching myself, you're about to send an email. These days, the stakes are a lot higher than asking for maybe you know, a free voucher at a Starbucks or something to raffle off. But you know, it is coming over that hurdle, you know, and just having almost a degree of fearlessness and being able to make the ask. You know, it's very much the art of making the ask is a big part of successful advocacy campaign. And in the early years of Global Citizen, that's all we had. We didn't have access to funding, access to power, you know, networks, access to celebrity influencers. So all we had was the power of vision and the power of making an ask.
Again, I tell my girls, the answer to every question you don't ask is no.
So true. You're a very wise man, I can already tell. But it's amazing though, because you know, I've seen so many times, even in my own life, where I've sat on something for so long, and you know, my wife might be saying, "When are you going to ask that person?" And you know, that fear is there, and you never address it. And it's funny. Eventually, you know, weeks later, I will eventually summon up the courage, make the ask. Of course, inevitably, when they say yes to something I've asked them to do, because I've left it so long and it's so last minute, you then have this really stressful moment to execute in a big way. But you know, we were just at this summit in Melbourne, Australia, and we brought out all of these celebrities. You know, we had Crowded House, great New Zealand band from years old, and then we also had the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson. And even here, I look at many of the speakers and, you know, the worst that they can say is no. And my view that I've seen is a speaker that might say no this time around, or someone that says, no, I can't help. You know, in some ways, even the act of engaging, you don't lose anything from it. And in many cases, they will remember you and you can build on something later. So, you know, what I always say is, yes, the worst that people can say is no, but often in year, it might take years, but often that no might eventually become a yes as well if you're persistent.
So if you're familiar with the marketing funnel, it's ADA, awareness, interest, decision, and action. And the first one on that is the awareness piece, is the ability or the action to get on someone's radar. That's the first step I hear. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I like that. I wasn't aware of that formulation, but I completely agree. And, you know, advocacy, I once had early on, this has gone back 12, 13 years ago, when we were starting Global Citizen, you know, there was a member of parliament in Perth, and he once said to me, he said, 90% of the battle is getting into the room with the right people, right? And he said, if you can do that, you can achieve a lot by just showing up, by just being in front of people. You can get a lot done. And I think that is probably part of that, maybe that awareness raising or getting on people's radar that you refer to.
That's correct. So Global Citizen, what exactly does it do? Is it a movement? Is it a nonprofit?
Yeah, so Global Citizen, it's a nonprofit registered 501c3 in the US, but it's really also a social movement, right? It's a movement of 12 million citizen advocates around the world. It's in many cases probably the world's largest social movement of action takers, specifically coordinated and targeted towards ending extreme poverty. And we often talk about our methodology of being one of pop and policy. And what I mean by that is we seek out ways to leverage the power of popular culture to really drive attention and really mainstream issues related to extreme poverty. And you break that down, there's different components of poverty, of course, is at lack of access to basic needs, health, education, water, food. There's also, of course, increasingly the impact of other big crises like we saw with the pandemic, which drove huge numbers of people back into poverty, but also, of course, climate change, conflict, and other big challenges. But importantly, we don't just drive attention towards these problems. There's plenty of groups out there who are, you know, will tell you what everything wrong with the world, but we also give people a way to take action. And we say at Global Citizen, we don't ask people for donation, we say action is our currency, and we give people a way to drive action and impact towards the biggest issues of our time. And I would say the final core ingredient to our DNA is we prioritize impact over ideology. So we always bring it back to how can we drive change in a way that's going to impact people's lives. We're not here to shame people. We're not here to pass judgment. We're not here to say this is our pure version of the world, and because you don't match it 100%, we're not going to engage with you. That's not us. And so, yes, is activism. We talk about advocacy. Yes, is awareness raising. We talk about, you know, driving impact. That's very much core to us. And in the last almost decade and a half now, Global Citizen has helped ignite more than 33 million citizen actions, everything from people sending emails, phone calls, text messages, tweets to their local elected officials, which has helped unlock and disperse more than $40 billion that's been distributed to incredible organizations that in turn have helped impact and improve the lives of more than 1 billion people around the world.
So tactically speaking, how do you encourage people to take action?
So in the book, I talk a little bit about, you know, the principles used to create change. And it's inspired a little bit by what I've seen in my time at Global Citizen, but also through the many interactions and experiences I've had working with other who I call policy entrepreneurs in nonprofits, foundations, philanthropies, businesses. And I outline really 8 steps by which anyone, whether you're a cultural icon like Taylor Swift or a business executive or an everyday citizen, can go about creating change, can go about creating impact. But really the starting premise is that there's many ways right now that people can contribute and make a difference to their local communities, their states, or even to their entire nations, right? We can donate to charity. We can register to vote if we're in a country like the US. We can have conversations with our friends and family. That alone is very important. Only 8% of American households talk about, for instance, issues like climate change a year. But we can also engage in policy. Even though when we talk about how to make an impact, often policy is not something that comes to mind, right? It's not something that if you ask, an ordinary citizen, they might not say, well, I'm going to impact policy. But the truth is, right now, we have a huge crisis of implementation. You know, you look at some of the big issues in the world. You know, the UN in 2015 passed the Sustainable Development Goals, which was a 17-point plan to end extreme poverty by 2030. At the halfway mark last year, just 12% of those goals had actually been achieved. And these were practical goals, things like reducing child mortality, providing access to water and sanitation. And the truth is we can't rely on government alone. We tend to think that government has all the answers to addressing policies. The truth is we need everyone involved, including citizens. The good news is, to answer your question, thanks to advances in communications and technology, even popular culture and the world around us, we actually have the ability as individuals to play a much deeper, more meaningful role in shaping policy than at any time in the history of humanity.
So how do you track the actions? You mentioned $40 billion of influence or effect. How do you track the actions and bring it back to that number?
So at Global Citizen, a few years ago, we were fortunate enough to receive some support from PricewaterhouseCoopers, who did this in a pro bono case. And I can talk about this now. You know, when we first started engaging with PwC, they said, we'll develop this framework for you to measure your impact, but you can't talk about it until we see it. It's whether it actually works or not. You can't talk about our involvement. And what we worked on with PwC was really two frameworks. The first was a robust due diligence framework. And what I mean by that is, at Global Citizen, we will drive the actions of citizens towards politicians, businesses, and we will ask them to make commitments, right? And those commitments can range from, you know, putting money into funding vaccination programs in developing countries to, say, eradicate polio. Or it could be a business that has agreed to set a short-term target to reduce its emissions by a certain percentage. You know, it can be a whole manner of commitments. But what our framework allows us to do is to ask a number of questions before we accept the validity of these pledges. And what I mean by accept the validity of these pledges is, we, of course, have huge platforms in New York. We're known very much for the annual Global Citizen Festival we host every year on the Great Lawn of Central Park, which brings together 60,000 people, global citizens, and we will give businesses and governments the opportunity to come along and pledge and make commitments on our stage and be recognized and applauded for their great work. But what the questions we ask in order to allow people to use our stage in order to amplify their commitments, we will ask them questions like, is this new money? Have you announced it before? Does the person announcing the commitment actually have the authority to make the announcement? I can tell you, in the spur of the moment, you often get government officials who want to be on stage, want to be recognized, and then you find out, oh, gee, your cabinet back in your capital, or your government, or your treasury department, sometimes you're like, have you actually spoken to your finance minister on this? Actually hasn't given approval. So this does happen. And in other times, you know, I've been in situations where, you know, we've accepted a commitment and you've got an ambassador on stage or about to go on stage, and then someone gives me a press release and you're like, isn't this money you're about to announce? Didn't you announce it 6 months earlier? And this is the press release here. So a lot of our work is actually making sure the claims that are going to be made represent the highest integrity possible, right? And what we find is this really ensures that or increases our ability to then hold decision makers to account, because only the highest legit commitments get recognized, and we can wheedle out a lot of the bad stuff through that process. Then, of course, once the commitment's made, you know, you always have this moment, right? Everyone gets bigger cheers, bigger applause. Everyone, politicians love the announceables. They love the soundbite. And then everyone has, you know, pats themselves on the back. They leave and everyone forgets about it. And I think the strength of a movement like Global Citizen, and I talk about this in the book, you know, yes, you need visionaries. Yes, you need diplomats. But you also need implementers, right? You need people to do the hard work of actually tracking, making sure the dollars, and it's not the sexy part of the work, but it's so important, right? And in doing so, you know, if you track that annual reporting, you can actually then track the dollars, making sure that if a government's pledged to give a certain amount of money, say to the World Health Organization to eradicate polio, that money actually flows. And, you know, this is important. It's important not just to make sure there's the impact, but too often I find in this world, we don't actually communicate back to those citizens who have taken action, the impact of their action taken. And that's so important to sustain people. You know, too much of advocacy today, I find is unhealthy, because it's built on outrage. It's built on anger. But that only sustains people for a certain amount of time. And I'm pleased to say by focusing on implementation, our experience is that we've only had a small handful of governments who have either reneged, maybe it's because there's been an election, or it could have been fairly reasonable grounds because of a crisis like the pandemic has disrupted a program. But in many cases, we have, you know, I think it's over 97, 98% follow through. And even in the small cases where there hasn't been, often we've been able to renegotiate. Maybe we give a country an extra year to deliver or pay up and deliver on their promises.
So you mentioned PwC, you mentioned two frameworks. One, you say the due diligence. Do they help with the implementation / accountability piece too?
They do. So what they did is they helped us set up this framework, both due diligence and accountability. And so we have 12 stages in a life cycle of a commitment, right? From the first stage being even before we've got the commitment maker on board, you know, we were talking about the ask before making the ask. So the very first stage is making the ask. Has an ask been made? Because this is also good data for us, right? It's good data for us to know for future and to track that, even if we're not successful, because a government can change, a minister can change. Maybe they're more inclined than previous administration. So we take that all the way through. And then the final 12 stage is, you know, we close it out once that final, not just once, say, money's been distributed to an organization, but once we've then spoken to the organization and they've actually delivered on the program that's actually had a material impact on people's lives. And there is a case study on the PwC website that they've posted that talks about this life cycle and these frameworks they've helped us with.
Now, you mentioned policies, headlines, and also the fact that sometimes governments change. How does that, so I'll give you a tactical example and then perhaps that'll be easier. So we have an election in the US this year. You know, last year the IRA was passed, Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of funding towards green energy, clean energy projects. There's some question as to how much of that policy will be affected by the upcoming elections. How does that play into what you do at Global Citizen?
So I would say in two respects. I would say the first, you know, in terms of safeguarding those gains, you have to look at, well, what is the power of strategic framing? What stakeholders might be able to help you, you know, protect the integrity of what we've already got? And there's a number of ways in which you can do that. You know, someone did joke to me, I was at the World Economic Forum this year, there was a business person who is, I think, one of the recipients of much of these subsidies in the Inflation Reduction Act. And he said, you know, there's no way they're going to get rid of this, even if Trump's elected. Just reframe it or rebadge it as the Trump the Trump Infrastructure Act or something like that, right? And so whether or not that's true, you know, there is an element of the need to look at, well, how do you frame things up? How do you do it in a way that's going to resonate with their narrative and how they're talking about it? You know, so I think that's one component. I think the second component is making sure you work with the right messengers, right? Those who are credible, those who are able to convey messages about the importance. And I would say that during the first Trump administration, we were actually able to get a lot done, which might surprise people because people look at Global Citizen, they look at international cooperation, development, and they make assumptions and they say, well, you know, we were able actually to get things done under the first Trump administration. He was pulling out of the Paris Agreement. He was pulling out the World Health Organization. And the answer was yes, because we spent a lot of time nurturing key relationships. And one relationship, which I talk about in the book, is the fact that, you know, we had a great relationship with the government of the United Kingdom, led by Boris Johnson. And so one way we were able to get commitments from America was actually to go often through the British ambassador in DC and make representations and to leverage that. I think at the time, you know, probably Boris Johnson was probably the closest leader on the world stage that was maybe similar in thought to how Trump viewed the world. And we were able to use that as a way in to have these discussions. So I think there's a number of ways by which we can go about it. And I also think there are measures in the Inflation Reduction Act that do resonate with conservatives, even if they don't agree with the elements of, say, clean energy. For instance, billions of dollars, and again, I talk about this in the book, billions of dollars have been put into deforestation or reforestation or planting trees across America's forests. And there's elements there that you can get support on both sides and then use that as a vehicle to build from. So there's a lot of options to protect what we've got. I often find, though, and I talk about ways to do this in the book, you don't achieve it by necessarily playing into polarization, right? You don't achieve it if many of the debates in Washington find themselves on a continuum, you know, where, you know, an issue might be incredibly polarized, chances are you're not going to make progress by playing into the messaging of that continuum, right? And so, you know, one novel tactic that policy entrepreneurs often use, it's called pulling the rope sideways. It's how do you take an issue, reframe it, pulling it sideways off of a very polarized dimension, and maybe it involves looking at it in some ways. And when it comes to clean energy, etc., there could be a whole bunch of ways to do that. Some people have spoken about, is it through the geopolitical prism? You know, there's a lot of angst in Washington right now about the rise of China. You know, is there a way there to use that to build a consensus around different forms of energy and different forms of infrastructure? I don't know, but in the book, I look at other ways on other issues by which this approach of pulling the rope sideways has been effective.
I would agree, specifically to add another dimension. And I think reframing the argument or the conversation, let's specifically around clean energy, one is national security. And it's really difficult to argue against that.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I've seen some of the debates already in Washington where you've got people like Lindsey Graham, et cetera, talking about, for instance, the concepts of carbon tariffs, right? Saying, well, okay, you know, we're now making progress, but there's other countries out there whose goods and services are far more carbon intensive than they are in America. So should we be putting tariffs at the border? Which in effect, I mean, if they did that, and look, people have their own thoughts on that. Some people will badge that as economic protectionism. But the flip side of that is for years, environmental campaigners have been campaigning for a price on carbon. And if you were to implement a tariff of sorts like that, which is based on carbon intensity, then that is to some extent a price on carbon or building in that that value, which for too long that externality hasn't been priced at all.
That, and I think regulation, specifically, you know, regulation perhaps in the EU that's going to happen, I think, in 2025 around scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. And then how does that play into international trade?
Exactly. And I know obviously here in America this week, as we've been talking, you know, the SEC's brought out its own regulations, right? And I believe in that case, it was only following scope 1, scope 2, it excluded requiring companies to disclose their scope 3 emissions. But, you know, and a lot of people, friends I've got in the climate environmental campaign space were disappointed. But my point is, and again, I talk about this in the book, a natural way to progress policy is the foot in the door technique, right? And this marks a real step forward, even if it's not to what everyone was hoping and wishing for in terms of their ideal scenario. But it represents a real mark forward. And again, how we got here was in large part because of the many voluntary efforts that have taken place. Like, people criticize many of the climate policies that companies have brought out over the last few years. And of course, there is greenwashing. A lot of those targets don't stand up to scrutiny. But in some respects, you needed that. You needed all of these commitments out there, whether they were good or not, in order to force the regulators' hands so that we could move the whole dialogue forward. And you've seen this in the EU, you've seen this in other jurisdictions, and now you're seeing this in America. And I think one other regulation I've been following is, you know, the US government, which is probably one of the largest customers in the world, right, in terms of contracts for goods and services. You know, either they have already introduced this or they're in the process of introducing this, and that is to require companies of a certain size and weight and volume in that are procuring or contracts with the US government to actually have near-term climate policies and emission reduction targets in place. And again, that's all through this foot-in-the-door technique over the last few years. And I talk about this example specifically in the book.
So let's get to the book. Why decide to write a book?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. And I asked myself that countless times last year, because I set myself a deadline of finishing the book before our daughter was born.
Which, I'll say, you know, were you just bored and waiting? What happened?
Yeah, it was crazy. You know, people were like, "Oh, I took sabbatical. I wrote it over this time," and I was like, "Yeah, I decided to somehow write it over the course of 6 months." So, doing many of these campaigns, some of them in support of getting financing for clean energy projects in developing countries, etc. So it was, a lot of it was written on planes, on boats, on subways, on my phone. But the truth is, the reason why I wrote it is I routinely get people reaching out to me on Instagram, social media, LinkedIn. They might be university students. Some cases I even have high school students reaching out. Other times they might be members of civic clubs like Rotary clubs. And many of them are asking, okay, well, how do you actually make policy change, and how can I be involved in those efforts? And they're looking for a little bit deeper than what we provide at Global Citizen. I mean, Global Citizen, if you want to take action on the issues we care about, poverty, climate change, then Global Citizen is great, and we've got many actions for you to take. But in many cases, people have identified their own challenges, right? It could be the case that maybe they're activists in South Africa and they're looking for a way to address the fact that period products, when girls get their periods, you know, it can keep them from getting to school if they can't afford those products. So it could be, you know, these activists have said, we believe the government should be providing this for free to adolescent girls in school. It could be other cases, maybe people have a particular issue with their community, their local mayor, you know, whatever the challenge is, people often have a problem and they're looking at how they can change policies. And so they come to me often, you know, to ask Global Citizen support, or they ask for advice. And in many cases, I mean, we're very mission focused, so I try and give the support I can to help them with their problems. And so the book was really me asking myself, okay, if I took a step back you know, Global Citizen is a big organization, 12 million members. You know, we have now upwards close to 100 staff. That isn't the answer to every single policy problem, right? And so I was saying, okay, if I went back in time to when I first started advocating and campaigning around policy change, what didn't I know that could have really helped me out and really made things far more efficient and smoother? And so through writing the book, I've managed to distill a lot of these observations and experiences down into 8 simple steps by which people can use to engage and influence the policy process. And I sum up these 8 steps as policy entrepreneurship, right? I believe that we need more policy entrepreneurs involved. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's not just lobbying, although direct advocacy is key, but it's also leveraging unconventional tactics. It's leveraging the power of partnership. It's leveraging the power of coalition building. It's leveraging the power of diplomacy. And my view is anyone can be a policy entrepreneur. Yes, you can actually be in office, you can be in government, and you can apply these tactics. You might even be a professional lobbyist who has an altruistic motive and wants to dedicate their time towards promoting a just and good cause. But you could easily be someone that isn't involved, and it's someone who is actually outside the policy process. You may not even have a formal role as well. So these tactics is applicable to a wide variety of actors and stakeholders. And I guess the last point I mention is, as well as being a practical playbook along these 8 steps, and I talk about how we need visionaries, diplomats, and implementers, you know, I also really provide a core for philanthropy to rewrite their playbook and to be far more willing to be ambitious and bold when they come to making grants to actually support policy entrepreneurs. Because as much as we need philanthropy into very targeted programs, and you need food banks to be funded, you need soup kitchens to be funded, you need schools in developing countries to be funded, you need all of that. My point is for philanthropy, you could have a 5, 10, even 15 times, you know, force multiplier effect if you're willing to back policy change efforts. And if those policy change efforts are successful, you could have a huge impact. And just one example I talk about in the book is, you know, going back 50, 60 years ago, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation funded research into how to improve the productivity of crops in parts of South Asia. Right. And they put all of this research into these sorts of different varieties of crop that might allow farmers to produce more from the same block of land. And they realized, the Rockefeller Foundation and other philanthropies realized, that if they just did the research, that alone isn't going to change anything. They actually had to invest in advocacy to get ministers of agriculture, et cetera, in many of these countries to actually implement many of these findings. And through that work, you know, and there was a researcher, his name was Norman Borlaug, who actually won the Nobel Prize for this. But through all of that work and all of that advocacy, translating this research into policy, it's estimated that more than 1 billion lives have been saved from starvation and through the green agricultural revolution that took place from the 70s onwards. So this can really have a huge material impact on people's lives.
Have you read the book, The Wizard and the Prophet?
But not the whole book, but parts of it for sure.
It's about Norman Borlaug. It's a phenomenal book.
Yeah, he's a great guy. You know, I mentioned this last year. I wrote an article when Oppenheimer came out, and I loved the movie Oppenheimer. I thought Christopher Nolan did a fantastic job. But you know, I contrasted the man who gave us the atom bomb with the man who helped. You know, and there were many people involved, but the man who helped save 1 billion lives. And you know, I'm looking forward to the day when Hollywood might make a movie about him and his story and this impact, because it is a wonderful story.
Well, there's a lot of contention there too, and inner conflict. You had the whole You know, at the same time, William Vogt was the opposite side of the count about, you know, keeping things natural and whether pesticides and population control. So it all falls under that umbrella, I guess.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. And I actually talk about this specific issue as an example in the book of, you know, division in our world and how you overcome. Because, you know, the truth is, you know, we often apply, and when I say we, I'm talking about specifically in the nonprofit sector, right, where we are focused on campaigning for policies. I think we inadvertently, especially in a hypercharged, polarized era, we tend to fall into the trap of often applying the purity test to every single issue. And Adam Grant from Wharton calls this by another phrase. He refers to it as the binary bias, right? The tendency to collapse what is actually quite complicated areas into, you know, categories of black and white rather than shades of gray. And the truth is, when it gets to policy implementation, you know, you're operating in an area where there are shades of gray. And so you look at this specific area of genetic modification in food. The truth is many of our foods these days, even if we don't realize it, have some form of genetic modification. And sometimes, you know, that sounds like it's to do with labs. It sounds like, you know, some people on some sides might think that's quite nefarious, right? In other cases, it's simply through using natural methods to really focus in on a certain type of variety of crops that might be more resistant or to say droughts or water scarcity, right? But one example I give in the book is the example of a genetically enriched product called golden rice. And this really goes back 20 years ago. And golden rice came out as a way to really use rice as a way to overcome deficiencies in vitamin A and address, you know, huge chronic levels of malnutrition for many children around the world. And the estimates of the impact that this product could have had in terms of lives saved and improved is huge. But there were a number of NGOs that, you know, waged a campaign that some would say was ideological in nature against the use of golden rice. And to the extent that, you know, the product got delayed in its use for years on, and then you eventually had all of these Nobel Prize winners in science come out and actually say to these NGOs, "You're doing a disservice. You're potentially putting lives at stake." And then in the end, many of these NGOs dropped their campaign against golden rice, and that's starting to be used. But this is where the idea of the purity test really can have very harmful consequences. And so, you know, in the book, I talk about the need to really, you know, recognize that advance in policy requires compromise. It requires mutual concessions. Usually, you know, when you've got a good deal, and it's usually because not everyone is entirely happy, right? But that's the nature of change. And I look at examples of that in the book, everything from the way LGBTQ rights advanced in the US throughout history, but also in instances of peace and conflict, right? You look at Northern Ireland, you look at the process by which the Good Friday Agreement came about more than 25 years ago, was rooted in these sorts of compromises in which not everyone got, and in fact, few parties got what they wanted, but that was necessary to bring about change. And I make the argument in the book that unless you're willing to engage in these sorts of trade-offs, right, then you can stay in your ivory tower, you know, surrounded by the sanctity of your pure vision and be able to bask in the righteousness of that to some extent, but ultimately have very little impact on people's everyday lives.
What's the new sexy term we can use instead of policy? Because I can see people starting to yawn as we say the word.
Yeah, you know, for me, I mean, I think I bring it back to impact, right? And I bring it back to changing people's lives. And so I talk about this as well. I think we need, you know, us as policy entrepreneurs you know, we need to come up with better ways to translate this language. And often I tell people, well, talk about the actual impact on people's lives, right? Translate it into human terms. You know, what does policies, when you're talking about illegal deforestation, right, and saving the Amazon rainforest, what does that actually mean for those communities involved? Does it actually mean better sources of income for indigenous communities who are the guardians of those rainforests? Does it mean better health, education outcomes? Like, try and bring it down to the individual level. And I think our job at Global Citizen, what we've often excelled at, is being translators, if you like, taking what can seem very jargony, you know, and translating that into very human terms. I give you one example. You know, I've long supported an organization called the International Fund for Agricultural Development, which is an incredible organization. In terms of bang for buck, it's probably one of the most effective organizations at supporting people who live in rural poverty in developing countries, and specifically with a focus on supporting farmers, right? Farmers who are all too often on the front lines of climate change, who are on the front lines of, you know, increased storms, hurricanes. You know, in Malawi last year when there was Cyclone Freddy, the biggest and longest living cyclone in the history of humanity, it destroyed more than 2 million farms, right? So this organization, EFAD, does incredible work, and we've been helping them over the last 2 years to raise $2 billion from governments and businesses, right? And I always say to EFAD, I always say, when we're going into meetings with ministers, et cetera, particularly those ministers who may not even know what EFAD is, I say, we might go into this meeting and we might not even use your name EFAD once. We might not even talk about what you're called. And that is okay, because the job of this meeting is not to tick a box. It's not to get them to engage with your issue. It's to get them passionate about your cause, right? And so one of the most powerful things we can do, and it's funny, you talking about the yawn, and I've seen this again and again, you know, with nonprofit leaders, in some cases, leaders in philanthropy, they go into meetings with incredibly busy people, and they go in with a litany of statistics, talking points, and factoids, right, to smack people over the head. And the reality is, well, they're going to walk out and just forget about it. And so how do you translate them into being an active champion for the cause, not for, you know, a particular policy necessarily, not necessarily for an organization? Because if you can get them passionate about the cause, then you can go back again and again, because policy needs change all the time, and convince them and sustain that support. So I talk about in the book, in particular, about how to tell stories of why. So stories of why a leader or a particular decision maker should care about a particular cause, but also stories of how. Solution-orientated stories, because I think right now there's a real yearning for solutions and stories of impact. And just to give you, you know, a very brief story, you know, I always think it's you know, it's stories that move people, it's humans that move humans, right? And one of my first campaigns, I've mentioned polio a few times, one of my first campaigns involved convincing the Australian government to contribute to polio eradication efforts. They hadn't contributed in a while, we were bringing them back to the table. And long story short, and I talk about how this happened in the book, but we were successful at getting the then Prime Minister of Australia to give us everything we wanted, to give us $50 million for polio eradication, convince other world leaders. And when she made that announcement, I asked her staff, I said, it's amazing she's responding and she's saying yes to everything we asked her to do, but why is she doing this? And her staff said, it's the stories. She loves the stories we've shared with her about the resilience of polio survivors who are now volunteering through leveraging their own lived experience. She loves the stories of everyday Rotarians in their local community who are fundraising, whether that's through quiz nights, movie nights. And finally, she loves the stories of the community health workers. The fact most of these health workers are mothers themselves. They're women who go door to door, often at great risk to their own safety, to actually persuade other mothers to also embrace the polio vaccine and to overcome resistance and stigma around the use of the vaccine. That's why she's doing this. She loves the stories. And so, you know, I always remember that. And that was our first campaign. And think through in all of our campaigns, you know, if there's too much jargon, et cetera, we say, well, how can we rebrand this? What is the story? What is the narrative we're trying to tell? Because the narrative is what gets people hooked.
Totally agree. I'm going to switch gears here. You've been with Global Citizen about 13 years or so. What have you learned about yourself and your journey?
It's a good question. I would say one of the things I've learned, to be honest, is the power of partnership. And what I mean by that is when we started Global Citizen, I always had a very hyper short-term focus. So I was always specifically focused on, you know, this particular challenge, convincing this particular decision maker of this particular policy solution here. Like I was always very tactical in my focus, right? And what I realized as the years went on is that I wasn't building any capacity, right? I realized that, okay, it was me going around driving, leveraging, of course, what we were building at Global Citizen. But I realized that so long as I was central to every effort to convince policymakers to embrace policy change from the issues we were working on, I realized we were not really going to scale and we weren't going to have exponential impact. And of course, eventually, you know, as you grow up, I'm in my mid-30s now, but you also become just far more acutely aware of the fact that nothing lasts forever, including us as human beings. And so rather than focusing on the question of what can I win today, I tend to now focus more on, you know, what can I help build that will last forever? You know, whether that's a movement, whether that's the capacity of other nonprofits. And I think a big part of the book is about exactly that, how to get greater philanthropy to invest in the capacity of nonprofits, invest in their ability to influence and shape policy, but also, you know, to really equip citizens and other organizations. And even at Global Citizen, you know, rather than us, you know, we kind of plateaued at having 100 staff. We like the idea that we're able to be nimble, we're able to be opportunistic, we're able to pivot. But often, you know, where we've had our greatest success, you know, I'm working in Brazil right now, for instance, on the Amazon, and where we've been able to have great impact is always where we are able to have local partners who get what we do and know how to leverage us, but it's led by them. And so, you know, that's probably been the biggest mind shift that's taken place. It requires, I think many advocates go through this journey. Because, you know, it takes a while to actually see the importance of sustaining that and having more voices to the table. And just one example of why this is important, you know, a few weeks ago I was asked by a philanthropist in Australia if we might help them achieve their goal of getting a supermajority in Australia, I think 2/3 of the population, to support policies related to clean energy. They've got this whole idea of getting the equivalent of the Inflation Reduction Act here in Australia, you know, and coming up with a similar approach. And so I asked them, okay, happy to have you build this, you know, find organizations and really build, invest in their capacity to be able to nurture this idea of a supermajority. I think they want to go from 30 to 40% of the Australian population supporting to, yeah, 60, 70%. So I asked them what range of grants they were looking at. And they said, well, we're kind of looking at maybe grants in the range of $100,000, right? And we look at making, they gave the impression it might be a small handful of grants in that region. And I went, okay, you want to double the amount of public support with effectively $100,000. And and then I just reminded them, I said, do you think those on the other side, you know, who will be opposing you, what do you think their budgets are?
Right.
You look at those that have invested in think tanks, research, you know, or no shortage of lobbying, right, on that side. And so I'm like, come on, we have to be real here. We have to invest in that capacity if we're really going to have an impact.
Yep. Well, you cast an eye towards the future. You mentioned sustainable. Let's fast forward to 2033. Your daughter will be almost 10 years old. She's gonna open a website, Fast Company, Forbes, Wall Street Journal. There's a headline regarding Global Citizen. What would you like it to read?
That's a very good question. It occurred to me when I wrote the book, just as a side point, those in climate advocacy circles, we speak about 2100 and it can seem very abstract and vague. And, you know, it brings it home in a far more personal way, the fact that, you know, my daughter will hopefully still be alive then and be living with the consequences. But look, I think the next decade or this decade is really consequential. I think it is this decade in which it will be determined whether or not we overcome geopolitical tension, whether we overcome, you know, really the ability to have emissions by 2030 and overcome a division in order to achieve that, right? I think this will be determined this decade, whether we avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And so, you know, I think a decade from now, I would love it to read that Global Citizen inspired, you know, another 30 million or even higher than that, 50 million actions in order to unlock the financing, you know, the $1 trillion. And that's a big gap because we've helped unlock $40 billion over the last decade. So to unlock $1 trillion over the next decade is not a small endeavor, but that's estimated to be the need of developing countries and emerging markets if they're to adapt to clean energy, right? Because if we don't do that, if we don't provide that funding, you know, and we don't provide that investment, then even in America and Europe, if we continue to reduce our emissions, the reality is in parts of Nigeria and India and Brazil and Indonesia and many countries around the world, that's where increased emissions will come from. And so if it can be Global Citizen unlocked 30 million X actions, you know, to help unlock $1 trillion to help fund a clean energy revolution, I think I'd be very, you know, I'd be very ecstatic, and hopefully the world would be as well.
Well, I think I've heard you say it's good to be naively audacious.
That's right. A naively audacious goal by putting it out there. But look, you know, I'm conscious we throw around terms like $1 trillion, right? But the reality is how many trillion dollars are under management right now? You know, the US spent almost equivalent to that last year on military and defense, upwards of over $800 billion in a single year, right? So the reality is, you know, this is achievable if we really want it to be. It's not a huge endeavor to reorientate our economic systems towards this outcome if we really wanted to.
I agree. Now, usually I ask for advice or words of wisdom, but I want to close out here with you giving us the Eleanor Roosevelt quote in your words so people can begin.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I say in the book that we all have the impact to make a difference. And in doing so, you know, it's my belief that right now in a divided era where people have high degrees of lack of trust in information and social media, one of the areas to look to build trust is in our own friendship circles, in our own families, amongst our own circles of influence. And it's my belief that if one of us takes an impact and we see the response from that, one of the powerful motivators that we can provide is to share that with our friends and family. And the research shows that one of the best ways to overcome people's sense of apathy, lack of agency, the sense of powerlessness that people feel, the sense of indifference, is to see others in their circles of trust making an impact. There's no better way. You know, we can make a difference because we have made a difference. And so in creating change, we actually have the potential to craft new stories of impact that can ignite countless more around. We just need to begin, because it all starts with us.
Well, Michael, it's been a real pleasure. I wish you all the best with Global Citizen, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thanks so much, Raj. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review on iTunes. And you can show your support by sharing our show with a friend or reach out to us on social media, where you'll find us under our Nexus PMG handle. If there's a subject or topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email, btu@nexuspmg.com, or contact me via our website, nexuspmg.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, where we share what we're reading and thinking about in the clean tech, green tech sectors. Bigger Than Us is a Nexus PMG production.